Okay, now I open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013. So first of all, we're having an informational hearing, Safe Homes and Healthy Communities, Meeting Domestic Violence Victims' Needs. And is Sybil here? Oh, there she is. Sorry, Sybil. Come on up, yes. And you're going to bring other people with you.
Thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
I have my first panel come up, and I'm going to show you a video at the beginning of the hearing. For the record, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. I have an incredibly fabulous panel of folks with me here today. I'll introduce them and then let them introduce themselves. And we wanted to, first of all, thank you so much for your time and attention. We're so lucky to live in Oregon here and to have such fabulous public leaders as yourselves who are willing to take the time to listen and inform yourselves and we know how much you care about this issue. So we really appreciate that. Jane Downing is the Executive Director of the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Center here in Salem, and she's going to tell you about the services that she provides and that other programs like hers provide across the state. And then Steve Belshaw is our fabulous representative of law enforcement here today, and he is with the City of Salem Police. He's going to tell you about law enforcement efforts on domestic violence and how they interact with some of the other public services that are available for victims. And Charlene Wessler is a fabulous member of the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, who's also a survivor and has graciously agreed to share some of the experiences that she's had and what she found helpful. So I'm going to do just a quick overview. We'll have a video, and then I'm going to turn it over to the experts.
Great. Thank you, Sybil. And as each of you speaks, please announce your name again, because this is recorded and people want to know who you are.
Thank you. So you'll hear today from many different perspectives about the issue of domestic violence and the impact it has on our families, on individuals, and on our communities. And I think our purpose here today is to have a couple of major themes to take away with you as you go forward in your roles as public leaders and the issues that come before you and the ways in which the legislature has the opportunity to interact with domestic violence and with solutions and prevention. There are three themes that I want to really stress and to keep in mind as we listen to each of these experts and consider the information. And those themes are, number one, that domestic violence is a multifaceted issue. I think when I first started doing this work, I thought of it only as a restraining order and civil protection order issue. That's what I knew how to do, and that's how I viewed the lens through which I was looking at that issue. And in my work at Legal Aid, I came to realize how many different service providers are out there in the community, how many other agencies in our state have a role to play, and how multifaceted the problem is. And we've learned that a third of the cases that are in our self-sufficiency system are generated as a result of domestic violence, a person leaving out on his or her own with no other support, needing the state's assistance to maintain and support the parent and the children in trying to move on. It's a generator of a third of our child welfare cases, where the state is intervening in a way to try to provide safety for children because of the threat in the home related to domestic violence. In Multnomah County, it's a driver for 50% of law enforcement cases. So it's a major impact on our public safety services, and of course that translates into the prosecutor's office and the criminal justice system. It's a healthcare issue. It's a leading cause of women's access to emergency rooms and emergency healthcare. It's a primary cause of homelessness for women and children, and people are often forced into sleeping in shelters and or on the streets if that's the only choice other than going home to an unsafe home. So it's also an education issue, and you'll hear people talk about the work that they're doing with teens and children in the schools. It's a substance abuse issue. There are many victims who turn to substance abuse as a method to deal with the crisis and cope. There also is an enhancing factor on some of the abuse that is perpetrated when perpetrators are using. It's a workplace safety issue. It's a family law issue. And many, many more. And so that theme is that it's a multifaceted issue and it touches all of the aspects of our communities. And therefore, my second theme is that it requires a multifaceted and coordinated response. And there's some incredibly good work going on in our agencies, thanks in good part to the work that you've done in helping to facilitate coordination in our communities, law enforcement is working with domestic violence shelter providers, is working with the public health departments, and with the child welfare and self-sufficiency. And when all of those people come together, we realize that we're dealing many times with the same exact cases and the same families, or with one aspect or another of the same issue. And if we're putting our heads together and trying to coordinate the way that we're responding, we provide a much more effective intervention, and we're much better able to help kids stay safe and victims stay safe in their homes. So coordination is a key theme as well. And related to that coordination is that we want there to be any open door. We want any time a person has the bravery and the courage to reach out and to identify that they need help, we want that request to be met, or that there is a warm handoff to the place where that help can be provided. We don't want to close doors in the face of people trying to do what they need to do in order to get safe for themselves and for their children. And then the third theme is that this is preventable. We can do things to stop this, break this cycle, and we've done many things. There are many examples where we're doing that work. We're interested in talking to you today about those good examples and how we want to facilitate that and do more as a state to coordinate our efforts so that we can prevent this in our homes and in our communities and in our state. So with that, I wanted to just leave you with those themes, and then I'm going to try to exercise my technological skills here and push play, which hopefully is something that I can do successfully.
Towards the end, he would get upset if I would do anything without asking him first.
That's the beginning.
Even if it was something for my kids, argue with me, scream at me in front of the kids and stuff, putting his foot in my face, throwing food at me, waking up with water being poured in my face.
But when it was physical, it was like a war in the house. It was so dramatic and traumatic. The isolation for me was by far more difficult than the physical abuse. I no longer had that security that no matter what happens, my parents are going to be there for me, my family is going to be there for me.
I got beat up really bad with a coffee pot, and it broke. It became a weapon, and it was sharp edges, and he was pounding me in my head. And I was on the floor crying, stop, stop, please, you're hurting me. And he was like, no, I'm gonna kill you, bitch, I'm gonna kill you. And I just remember getting real weak and like seeing my blood on the floor. And that's when I knew then that I had to go.
Well, he had threatened to kill himself, and then it went from that to that he could kill me and then himself, because then I'd be gone. People say, well, why don't you just leave if you're not happy or whatever? And it's not that easy.
I was facing, not having a place to live, I didn't have work. It was very complex.
I didn't have any control of my finances. I didn't know how much money we had in the bank half the time. He paid all the bills. Almost everything was in his name. You are down to the point where you've lost everything. And then your self-esteem is like so shallow that you think less of yourself.
Oh, I needed schooling. I needed housing. I needed clothes. I needed my kids. So I had to worry. I had a lot that I had to correct in my life in order to get on my feet. I hid away in the streets for a few weeks, but then I came to the shelter.
She would call me and see how I was doing. She put me in touch with an attorney that I could talk to if I had questions.
But for somebody here to say, we understand and we're here to listen, well, it made a big difference because I had nobody. I had nobody to talk to. It's a big difference.
It took 10 years for me to get out, unfortunately. It took 10 years, and it was the last 2 years that it got so bad that I finally said, towards the end, I have to get out.
And other places looked down on me. They thought I wasn't going to make it. I never got my kids back. I was going to die of drugs. I was going to go back to my husband. I never heard that from them. They said, Shreve, you can do this. You're going to make it.
They're here to help. They're here to encourage you and help you to do whatever it is that you want to do to make your life better.
You're not the one that has to be embarrassed because you're not the abuser. You have to lift up your head and be strong.
What they gave me was a chance. I couldn't have gone through that by myself. I really needed that guidance.
It gave me the power to have my life back that I haven't had for a long time. It's strange to know that somebody cares.
Thank you. That was graciously shared with us by the Gateway Center for Battered Women in Colorado, actually, and they created that as a means to explain the importance of the services that they provide, and they were happy to share it for our committee hearing discussion today, and I think it is a good setting for the importance of the work that Jane and other programs like hers do across the state.
A question, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Quick question before I forget. A great show, video. And on the last slide, it said 3 women have been sexually attacked or raped and 28 beaten. Was that in Colorado? What's the geography of that?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, that was national statistic.
National. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to talk to you about this really important subject. I'm Jane Downing. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and we serve Marion County. And I did want to let you know that Kirsten Heidel, our Youth Services Coordinator, wanted very much to be here also today, but is actually in the schools providing preventative information and education to the students there. And she's been there all week. So she's working really hard. So I apologize for her absence. I know she'd love to be here and see you once again and address the committee. What you saw in that video is what we see every single day in our work. All across the state, there are programs who are meeting one-on-one with individuals who are facing all of the issues you heard there. And what I can tell you based on the work that we're doing is that individuals are receiving services from shelter programs in every county is represented by some program who is helping them. But we have seen an incredible increase in the number of individuals who are coming to us every single day. Our program alone here in Marion County has almost doubled in the number of individuals who are coming to us for services in the last 3 years. Mostly because why we're seeing that is because more than 150 individuals, adults and children, have been murdered due to domestic violence since 2009. Last year in Marion County alone, 45% of the homicides were domestic violence related. 3 women and 3 children were murdered in 2012 in our community alone. You multiply that across the state, and unfortunately this is happening in every community, and we've been on a horrible wave of domestic violence homicides. And so what you have, the good news is people are reaching out in record numbers. We sometimes come to our office and we have 3 or 4 individuals standing on our porch waiting to have restraining orders or safety planning alone, because the calls that we've received are from individuals saying, I'm afraid I'm the next one. I'm afraid my children are the next one. And unfortunately, they don't know. And we don't know which one it will be. And so providing a safety net for services from our program, from the police department, from child welfare, all of us, it takes all of us working together in order to be able to build that safety net for victims. And I love what Sybil said about no wrong door. And that's what we want in our community, that everywhere an individual goes who's in need of help, they know that they're going to be able to get help. They're going to be able to get connected with services. And what I can tell you is you have urban programs and you have rural programs. And each face really unique challenges. For the urban program, what we hear most often, if there's not shelter beds available, and unfortunately thousands of requests last year alone were turned away because there were no beds, and what they're being told is their only option is to ride, you know, transportation around until something becomes available. In the rural areas, you have the situation where if there's no shelter beds, they're sleeping under bridges, they're sleeping out in parks, and you have that mix of both communities facing there's not enough housing, there's not enough services to be able to provide that. Our program tries to do some unique things, and other programs around the state try to do that. And yet, what I'm sure you've heard over the years and continue to hear is that there's not enough of our services, and there's not enough housing, there's not enough transportation, there's not enough of those pieces to build a true safety net. And the Centers for Disease Control have given us some numbers and said about, you know, one-third of women in the state of Oregon have faced domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking in their lifetime. That multiplies into between 40 to 50,000 women in our community alone. We had 18,000 contacts last year, so we know we're not reaching everyone. And then you multiply that out in the state, and you look at those gaps in services, and it becomes a huge issue. Where are people able to go? How are they able to access services? And I got to tell you, I've never faced a time like we're facing right now, where I'm not sure. We have 11.7 FTE. And about 30 volunteers, but we aren't always able to serve everyone that we need to serve. And you multiply that out across the state, and that's what we're facing. And so you coming together and doing this, I want you to know how much we appreciate you hearing our voices and hearing the need, and we know that you can help us be able to deal with that situation. So I thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson and committee members. My name is Steve Belsch. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police for the City of Salem and the Police Department. I will tell you, starting my 25th year in law enforcement, 25 years ago, I wouldn't be sitting in a hearing like this about social services, that law enforcement and social services didn't team up together. We had different agendas. And when I got into law enforcement, and you talk to any police officer out there, they got into this job to help people and to make a difference. And that's what I wanted to do. And I thought I could do it and do it by myself. And I'm finding out I can't do it. Now, I'm a very effective police officer. I'm very active and hold people accountable for bad behavior in my community, and it's not enough. I need my team members. And while Jane has talked to you about some of the challenges we face, there are some things out there that can be replicated, and that can't. But again, the challenge is personnel and dollars. In Marion County and in Salem specifically, we have dedicated some of our patrol officers to get training on domestic violence type of crimes and to do more thorough investigations and to take the time to listen to these victims, not just go and clear that call. We've realized that gap, that we need to get victims services and get them support right away. So we have advocates that will respond 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on scene with the officers to provide immediate assistance to victims and then get them partnered with Women's Crisis Service, get them partnered with the DA's office. We've seen that pay off. across the country and across the state of Oregon, the prosecution rate on domestic violence cases is roughly in the high 40s to the low 60%. In Marion County, by partnering with these folks and getting the victims involved, our prosecution rate averages about 83 to 85%. And we're finding that we're holding people accountable, we're seeing less repeat offenders and those types of things. And building those relationships, we can get the job done and keep victims involved. As you see, you look at the statistics across the country, violent crime is going down. That's what the numbers say, but if you watch the news and read the paper, you wouldn't tell that from the news stories, because the violent crime you see is more violent than it's ever been. People solve problems, a lot of times minor problems, with violence, and we have to send that message in our communities that that's not acceptable. There are other ways to solve problems, and there are other ways to do that. And so the programs that Jane is talking about, working with the schools and things like that, because we are seeing more violence than with younger people and violence and crimes that we never saw before. The violence isn't in the robberies and those kinds of things. It's in the interpersonal relationships and the domestic cases. So there are things that are out there, and you can make a difference in across the state, listening to these victims and knowing that these crimes, we're seeing it in the teens, we're seeing violence and dating at 13, 14 years of age to victims in their 70s and in all walks of life. And so it is an issue, and you need to see what it is in our state and is in your community and listen to these people, because it's those relationships are not our relationships. And that's the challenge for the officers. It seems so simple. Just leave. And it's not that. And we tell the officers, you need to sit down and listen to what they're saying. Listen to what they're telling you. And when they do that, they have an understanding of what's going on, and they can better help them and get them the advocates and those types of folks. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson and committee members, for taking the time to listen to this subject. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my experience.
Your name first.
Oh, sorry, I'm Charlene Wessler. I'm a survivor of domestic violence. After my event, I kind of took it upon myself to use my voice to help where I can. So I hope that my voice here is going to help others to not feel the hopelessness that I felt in my situation. I was married for 9 years and in a relationship with somebody with mental illness who was unwilling to face that. We had been separated for a while, and his attempts to get us back together didn't work, so it became very physical. I'm not like most, I wouldn't have considered myself a somebody in a domestic violence situation, even though there was the emotional and mental control in that. It just boiled over into one huge event in 2008. Which was very violent. It was a 6-hour ordeal one night. My ex-husband is currently spending 15 years in prison for that night. It's very serious, but that wasn't the worst thing that happened to me. The worst thing was is after that, I had to pull all the pieces together and figure out how to carry on with my 3 children, survive the event, come back, and be a member of society, a productive member of society. So the first obstacle that I faced was I had just been attacked in my home, and I didn't want to return there. I didn't want to go back there, so I needed a place to live. I did receive help from DHS with the domestic violence grant. I should say first, I should back up a little bit and say that that the officers that responded to my house, I did have probably 3 contacts with police to try and help
My ex-husband tried to hang himself the year before the event against me, and the police officer at that point did say, you need to go get a restraining order right now, because he's going to do this first, and then he's going to come after you next. And like I said, I didn't see myself as a victim, and I kind of disregarded that. I thought, he needs help, and I'll be okay. So the police in my situation were familiar with what was happening, even though I wasn't. And they did, they were my first point of contact as far as help goes. And there was, Mr. Belshaw said, there was an advocate there on site to point me in the general direction. There's just really a lot to do to pick up the pieces when all of a sudden you don't have a place to live, all of a sudden you have to relocate, all of a sudden your children have to go somewhere else, and you have to keep your job because that's what you need to help you survive. So the biggest hurdle that I had in my situation was not the vicious attack on me. It was coming back afterwards to put the pieces together. I'm coming up on the 5-year anniversary of that date, and the help that has been given to me through support, through advocates, through grants, helped me stay somewhat stable. In the time since the attack, I have opened my own small business. I will graduate in December with my accounting degree, and I have a child who has graduated high school and a couple more that I'm working towards that. So I just want to say that these services are very, very important, and I know that I came from a place before this attack where I kind of had things together, and people said throughout my experience, wow, you really got this all together. And all I could think about when people said that was, what about the people who don't? Well, what are they doing? Because I'm barely holding on here. Well, what are those people doing? So I find it very important now to come and share my experience and just give you all kind of a little piece of the difficulties that we all face that maybe we don't realize. I never would have thought twice about speaking up for domestic violence, you know, 10 years ago. But my life has changed, and I just want to make sure that I can shed a positive light for some other women out there. So thank you for taking the time to listen to my story.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you. Any questions of any
Yeah, I do, Madam Chair.
Representative Olson.
Sybil, maybe you can chip in. Steve, you can maybe too, because of your background. And most definitely, Jane, I would be interested in your thoughts on this. We have, you know, I'm just writing down some notes to myself and what I've heard all four of you say. In the 70s, we moved forward with domestic violence notification. Also, toward the end of the 70s, we moved forward with the Domestic Violence Act, the DVA, where you didn't have to have somebody sign off on, you know, an arrest. And for it being a Class A misdemeanor to do it, you could just go do it if you were at the scene and you saw violence present. Then eventually in the 80s, we moved forward with the Class C misdemeanor or Class C felony on the issue. So I say that, though, because there's been a development. You know, Sybil, I've testified, or I mean, I've carried a number of bills over the last 8 years in this building on trying to improve things, too, in this environment. But Jean, I heard you say, quote, I have never faced a time as I have today with the increase of everything that's going on. So and I never did hear anything from anybody of why. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I can sit back and see the escalation going on, something fierce, but it just doesn't seem like what we try to do here from the legislative perspective for laws really has a whole lot of a dent.
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, thank you so much for that question, because actually I meant to say this. It's because of all the good work that you all have done and everyone else in our state is doing. That's why the numbers are going up. Actually, that's a good sign that they're going up. That means more people know about services. More people are accessing those services. It's not that we have more victims. It's that we have more people who are willing to come forward, and we are doing a better job of saying this is an important issue and we're going to do something about it in our state. It's exactly because of all the good work that you did that more people are coming to us than ever before, and we're overwhelmed. Unfortunately, the money for advocates and the money for police departments to be able to face this issue, as you all know, has, you know, faced some cuts, and not just from state, but federal and private grantors and community dollars as the economy got bad. And so when I say I've never seen a time like this, we have more people coming forward, which is a great and wonderful thing. We just have less resources to be able to help them. And so it's reached a huge crux for me, and I've been doing this for 21 years, for me just saying, wow, we need some help. We need some serious help. But it's because of the good work. So feel good about the things that you've done. You've made a huge difference for victims and survivors. And that's not lip service. That's really true. You have.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was feeling that same way after we've worked for so many years so hard. It's like you're telling me it's getting worse.
Yeah. Oh. So wait a minute. Well, I was kinda, I mean, it was a great deal. I mean, you to go to a scene and say, hey, I can arrest somebody. You don't get it. Okay, never mind. You can remove somebody and prevent any further harm for right then. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually get it, too.
So it's explained that in the past, they had to have the person who had been hurt, they had to testify against the abuser.
Well, they actually...
And that was...
No, you're on the right track.
Yeah.
But they actually had to file a complaint.
Right,
and
yeah.
See, and that was the thing. And if you had the wife not wanting to do that...
Yeah.
I mean, you had a continual repeat.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And it was very, very dangerous for a wife to do that,
mm-hmm.
because then he would really retaliate. Yeah. So mm-hmm. thank you for that.
I agree. And just to speak to that, your question a little bit more, Vice Chair Olson, the climate has changed.
Mm-hmm.
When you and I went to high school and you had a disagreement with somebody, you went out behind the gym and you settled it with fists or whatever, or arguing or whatever. You didn't have to worry about somebody driving by and shooting up your house, or the whole level of violence in our society and solving problems with greater violence has just become a problem, not only in domestic violence but just in general.
Mm-hmm. And Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson and members, I would echo those comments, and also just say I know that many of you have sponsored or supported workplace protections in housing, protections at the Department of Human Services, the fabulous coordination that's happening now between child welfare and domestic violence advocates. You'll hear more about that in the next panel, but those protections are making an actual difference in people's lives on a daily basis, and we see that and hear that from people coming through, so we're very grateful for that. And there is a sheet that I put together that I think should be an OLIS if it's not, or it will be, that summarizes some of the great work that's been done by this committee and others in providing those protections. And I think the escalated sort of instances that we're seeing come forward provide us with an opportunity to provide intervention and assistance, and in that way we're changing people's lives and helping to break the cycle.
Thank you so much. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I thank you for your presentations and your personal stories as well. I'm looking at the sheet you provided us with some of the different programs and so on, and I'm noticing, I mean, it does say selected programs, but you know, I was thinking about, you mentioned substance abuse, mental health issues. You know, I consider myself to be a victim of domestic violence with an alcoholic and abusive father. And I always wondered why my mother didn't leave him. I mean, she didn't. He finally died pretty early from his alcoholism. So she was able to be relieved of that issue. But, I think that you mentioned it's a systemic problem, and certainly the children and really the whole family is affected. But I spoke to a bill that's on the floor today for equal pay for women, for crying out loud. And to me, that's what we're really talking about, is really very systemic problems, I would say structural problems in our society that keep women in a secondary sort of position. And it, you know, it isn't just women. I mean, children as well. And it's like, so, you know, I guess I struggle with how do we really change things at that level. I think we can create laws, we can lock people up, we can do those kinds of things. But unless we really change the way we look at things, the way we look at each other, that's what needs to happen, I think.
That's a good point. Thank you, Representative. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming and sharing your stories today. And I'm glad you asked that question so I don't feel quite so depressed. Representative Kinnegar, wait a minute. It seems we have
a question. Well, no, I was just going to piggyback on what Representative Gallegos said, and thank you for your work in the schools. That's part of changing that culture, too.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have collaborative intervention to support families, domestic violence, child welfare, co-location. So again, thank you for coming. Sybil, why don't you start ahead?
I'm going to introduce. So thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Our next panel is a presentation regarding a great example of how collaboration can really make a difference in breaking the cycle for children who are living in homes where there is domestic violence and for the parents who are trying to be protective but are struggling with abuse themselves. I want to open this presentation by reading a letter, if I may, that was written by a survivor who had received services from this fabulous co-location project. And by co-location, what I mean is having a domestic violence advocate who is a support person for victims who are parents, located at child welfare and self-sufficiency offices, so that when those parents come into the system because of the need to support or protect their children, the DHS caseworker can focus on providing that intervention for the child, which is their mission and their mandate, and the domestic violence advocate can take the time to provide the support and safety planning that's necessary for that parent who's a victim struggling with her own abuse. And that collaboration has made just one of the most remarkable differences I've been aware of in recent times in my work with victims, and we're very, very grateful for it.
And I just want to call out the previous committee, Human Services Committee, worked really hard to get these folks in with the co-location. So, and I know you worked really hard on that, Sybil.
And the chair and the committee sponsorship of that bill and then of providing funding for that service has made a remarkable difference. So I'll read this letter, and it starts out, "To whom it may concern, my name is... I have three beautiful children, 11 years old, 8 years old, and 2 years old. When I first met with my advocate, I was about 2 weeks clean off of meth and in a very abusive relationship. I'd lost custody of my son to the state and my daughters to my mother. I was in major denial and very depressed. Jillian and I met once a week, and she was my biggest advocate. She helped me help myself. She gave me Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous group lists. She gave me advice on how to get a restraining order and how to access the resources necessary to do that. She connected me to the Criminal Justice Victims Unit, Janice, at the courthouse. But most of all, she was there for me when I was truly alone and lost. Until I met with Jillian, I had no idea that the relationships I'd been in were all so unhealthy. I had never talked to anyone about any of this. I am so grateful to have had her as my DV advocate. After 6 long, underlined, months and a lot, underlined, of work, I have my children returning home, a great support system, and most of all, my self-worth. There's light at the end of the tunnel and a beautiful future in store for my family and I, free of addiction and anger. Thank you." And it's signed. So I wanted to turn this over to Jessica and Jillian here today, who can tell you a little bit about the collaborative work that is getting done as a result of this model.
Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and committee. My name is Jessica Hunter, and I've been a caseworker with child welfare for about 13 years. I've done protective service work and permanency work, which is to ensure kids have safe and prep in. And I'm really excited to be here this afternoon. I want to thank you for your willingness to hear from us and also your interest in the issue. It's exciting to be able to report back the outcome from my perspective as a worker of the collaboration of having domestic violence advocates actually in the child welfare branches. And I'd like to just touch on briefly the benefits I've seen in families and to children when we collaborate that way. And the benefits play out in many different ways, but the nice thing is that there are benefits from the very first contact with a family during the investigation stage throughout the life of a case. So when we're talking about initial contacts with families, we're talking about a protective service worker needing to go in and make sure kids are safe and investigate to see if abuse or neglect to children is occurring in a family. And when we do that and we are told that domestic violence is happening in the family or is reported that it is and there's a concern, then you're talking about a parent, a victim, who's in a terrible position of having a child protective service worker kind of question and about your parenting and talk to you about keeping your kids safe, when on the other side you are a victim with sometimes very little ability to do those things that you need to do to ensure your kids are safe and not experiencing abuse and neglect. So I find that when I was doing the protective service work, that it certainly reduced the trauma to a parent. They're, you know, living in that state of trauma and having those feelings ongoing. To have an advocate come out kind of offset the intrusiveness and the unpleasantness of having a child protective service worker talk to you about concerns about your kids. And also, live, right in the moment, I would frequently experience very rich discussions and rich planning sessions around safety, education, and those types of things. And I found that to be just really an awesome thing for mothers and kids. Also, it's certainly one thing for me to hand a brochure to a mother and say, here's their advocacy center in town and here's the phone number. I think it'd be a good idea if you give them a call, as opposed to having this human element and this person come with me who's actually sitting in someone's living room, involved in the discussion and actively doing some planning and responding to concerns. I believe just right in that instance, a mother and children are becoming less isolated right there. There's a connection. There's a connection to a resource, and it's a critical resource. So that's phenomenal. I am schooled and educated by my advocates on a regular basis, and I appreciate that. They do help us a lot with our points of view, our perspective. You know, we have a unique role in cases of domestic violence, and that is child protection, and there's a unique role with the advocate of, you know, victim support and education. So, you know, when we come together, then you have a really holistic kind of approach to the issue, and I think it's phenomenal. On the back end of my work, when we're looking to ensure safety for children and permanency for children who are involved in the child welfare system, I have frequently had an advocate involved to, again, assist with safety planning. I work in a rural community. We don't have some of the resources that perhaps other communities have. So you're heavily reliant upon relationships and creative planning and some aspects of living and working in a rural community. So the relationship piece is important. And together, we can oftentimes do some creative planning to ensure that kids are safe and whenever possible, safe at home with parents where they do best. So that is kind of an additional benefit to the rural communities of Oregon. I have a couple of examples, if that is okay, of how
Why don't you give us one? We're sort of running out of time.
So the case example that comes to mind when I was a protective service worker is I received a referral that was in regard to a mom who was walking down I-5 barefoot, 3 in the morning, very disoriented. She was picked up by a law enforcement officer. The immediate concern was mental health. This mom was very shut down. She was actually taken to our mental health ward in our community, which is where I made contact with her. And through the help, mom made some statements that alluded to some domestic violence, and through the help of an advocate to get in and work with her, we actually fleshed out the extent of what was occurring in the home, which was terrible, and I would call it that this batterer was terrorizing his family, doing things like throwing all the food in the house out in front of his kids, saying, well, we'll all just starve to death together right in the home. So there wasn't a black eye, there wasn't a broken wrist, there wasn't physical injury happening to this mother. She over time, living in this situation, she just shut down. She wasn't able to care for herself or her kids very well at all. And it was very hard to get to those dynamics in the family without the advocate, because it was very scary for this mother, and her functioning was just so poor. It's very important that we get very good information when we're doing assessments. We need well-informed safety plans for kids in home and out of home. And so that piece worked really well. And also, it just, the momentum kept flowing because this advocate helped this mom with the restraining order and housing. And this mom was actually able to maintain and have her children in her care and to get some recovery when I passed the case on. That was in an excellent place. So that will always stand out in my mind, the way she was and the horrible things she and her kids were going through. I'll never forget that referral. So thank you very much. I appreciate
thank you.
Your time.
I appreciate the testimony.
My name is Jillian Rivas-Davila, and I am with Columbia County Women's Resource Center, and I'm the co-located advocate in the St. Helens office. I work with all of Columbia County. I want to tell you a little bit about what the co-located advocate does. It provides services both for survivors and also support for DHS staff. Survivors are able to access in-depth safety planning, domestic violence education, systems navigation, community referrals, resources. They're also able to get ongoing support both individually and in groups. For DHS staff, I provide training for the staff, which really increases awareness about domestic violence and about survivors' experiences. I consult on DV cases and specific issues surrounding domestic violence, and as Jessica was saying, go out on home visits as well. Although both the community advocates and DHS staff have really similar goals, with family safety, with having healthy lives and being free from abuse, we have different roles. The child welfare worker is really looking at that child safety piece. The self-sufficiency worker is looking to provide services based on eligibility. As an advocate, I'm really able to provide a wider scope of options for these survivors that really custom fit their individual needs at that moment. And those needs shift and alter, domestic violence education, we know that this time again, we see that this leads to prevention. By being able to educate a client about domestic violence through their own story, it's really validating. And, they're really able to become empowered and, taking that knowledge, they can really understand their experiences and what's happening to them. Because sometimes it can just seem like it's moving on and they don't have any control. Working with, doing effective safety planning, we know that safety planning with the survivor, protecting the survivor leads to protection of the children. This is something that is so unique to the advocate being able to do this in the child welfare system. That emotional safety piece is really crucial. In times of crisis, we know that survivors really only absorb about 10% of what the information that they're hearing, and in the child welfare system, often that message that's heard by survivors is failure to protect, and that fear, which is huge, really revolves around the removal of the children. As an advocate, I can really take the time to help survivors really process all of this information that's being presented to them. And, by doing this, it leads to better communication with their DHS worker and can really start building trust with that worker. When survivors gain understanding, about the positive, intentions of DHS, they're really able to start accessing some of the services that are there. The piece between domestic violence and the connection with substance abuse is huge. Education of the survivor can really help them gain a new understanding, of what that connection looks like. It's often seen in terms, as Sybil mentioned, of using substances as a result of coping with abuse and as a result of coercive tactics. You know, we've seen that by presenting healthy coping strategies and additional support, survivors, like the one, the letter that Sybil read, you know, they are a lot more open to, you know, receiving recovery services. And this has been a really consistent thing that we've seen. You know, we're in our office in St. Helens, we're really working also on improving our upfront services. You know, it's also shown that reassault can be prevented by 70% when survivors have access to emergency safe services and support in times of crisis. So that early contact with survivor identification with the eligibility worker, that initial contact on the home visits, and you know, knowing that DHS is often the only point of contact for some of these really isolated survivors. You know, there's a lot of limitations with rural survivors. I also work in a rural area. You know, safety planning can be really difficult when there's no confidentiality, you know, in the community. And also, too, the barriers to service between, even if someone does get emergency services, they're not able necessarily to have, to access, you know, those funds that are provided by DHS because there may not be any housing, there's not any transportation. And so even though there are services available, having that advocate, you know, although we can't resolve or help with some of those limitations, what the co-located program can do is it can allow survivors, you know, not to have to face these realities alone, you know. And so, you know, every day I see how this program is benefiting people in this community, and I really want to thank you for supporting it, both as an advocate and as a survivor.
Thank you very much, Jillian. It was very interesting listening to the letter and how the survivor was so pleased with the services that you had provided. When I think about her having been on meth and had stopped in a very short time, had lost her children, lost her home, just what a terrible state she would have been in, and how helpful it was to have someone like you, Jillian, there to help her navigate through the system so mm-hmm. she could not only stay off drugs but get her children back. And that's the best for the whole family. So thank you so much. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you again for your work.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for coming today. And we have a different panel. We have Working with Teens, which we are very interested in. Megan Kovacs and Anna Williams.
Well, our next panel is coming up, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I would just emphasize one point that was clarified in evaluating some of the co-located programs that are going on, both with child welfare, and there's another federal grant that is piloting some really great interventions that are co-located between public health agencies and domestic violence agencies. And consistently, what we're finding is that many of the survivors had never before had any contact with a domestic violence advocate. So this public health office or this child welfare office was their first point of contact, and it's what helped them get into services. And so, you know, that's a terrific statistic to know about. And I am really excited to hear from Megan and also from Anna, who are two fabulous advocates doing work with our teens to help avert this crisis in the first place. And so,
terrific.
Thank you so much. Hi, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having us here. My name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the Education Coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. And I work primarily in the Portland community and also statewide on prevention and education, which really speaks to your question at the beginning, Representative mm-hmm. Olson, of, you know, we are constantly addressing this issue and have been for a number of years, but what are we really doing to stop it from happening? It continues to happen. And, you know, the resources that we have that are addressing intervention are critical. This is still something that's happening all around us. This is happening in every single community, and this is affecting our entire community in massive ways. And I think that really speaks to the importance of prevention. You know, I don't think often and traditionally we have really thought about domestic and sexual violence as preventable issues. But the reality is they are. These are things that don't have to happen in our community, but we have spent a lot of time addressing the problem and not taking steps back to really look at what the root causes are, why this happens in our community, and how we can start changing, you know, the sociocultural norms that support violent behavior happening in our community. And that's what a lot of programs throughout the state have started taking a look at, including my program at Raphael House. You know, we are really looking at addressing the cultural norms that support domestic and sexual violence, how we can start dismantling those sociocultural norms so that we can create a community that's not only safer for everyone, but where domestic and sexual violence no longer happens. I think that the first step in that process, I know that many of you were a part of this, the Healthy Teen Relationship Act that passed last year and was enacted in January, which went about changing benchmarks and standards for healthy sexuality education to incorporate domestic and sexual violence prevention, and also to require all school districts to adopt a teen dating violence policy, thus putting, you know, domestic and sexual violence on the radar of schools, the importance of education, the importance of addressing this early and often as a part of what it means to be healthy. And, you know, that was a really good first stepping stone in toward the work of preventing domestic and sexual violence. But I think that there is a lot more that needs to happen in our community before we really reach the ultimate goal and our end goal of preventing this and really dismantling the socio and cultural norms that support this. One of the things that we're doing in Multnomah County in the next school year, which is really exciting and pretty progressive, is addressing domestic and sexual violence as not only something that is a women's issue, something that affects women, but, you know, this is something that affects our entire community. How do we really prevent this? By engaging men in this work, by men engaging men in this work. So we are implementing a nationally recognized prevention program called Coaching Boys into Men, which is where coaches will teach their student athletes about healthy relationships. So not only is it men engaging men, it's men engaging men in sports culture, which is a really interesting and progressive program, and that's a program out of Futures Without Violence, which used to be called the Family Violence Prevention Fund. So this is a proven model that has shown that it actually does increase the safety in the community and the amount of attention paid toward healthy relationships. It is a prevention model. We have also been doing school-based presentations around kind of dismantling the cultural and gender norms that support that, speaking to, you know, the question that you were speaking to earlier. This is a much larger systematic issue. It's not just something that happens in families. We really need to address, you know, the ways that we think about gender, the ways that we think about relationships, the ways that we think about sexuality in our communities. And, you know, that's what healthy sexuality and healthy relationships education is really getting at. And there have been some statistics that have come out recently through a statewide survey that was done by a woman who was working with the public health department in Multnomah County, who was contracted by the CDC. And she did studies of health teachers and what they felt comfortable teaching. Her name is Stephanie Murray. And she health teachers and what they were comfortable teaching, and then students and what they were actually learning, which was a really interesting study that showed us that, you know, students really love having guest speakers in the classroom, and, you know, it's kind of unfair to health teachers to require them to be experts in every single topic in the field of health, so it's really helpful to partner with advocacy agencies to really look at and address health in a holistic way. So that's one thing that, you know, Raphael House has been working on, and I know a lot of statewide programs have been working on as well, and I think Anna is going to speak to that in just a moment.
What age group are you talking about in the health committees?
So what my program works with is middle school and high school students. I know that there are a number of other programs in Multnomah County that are addressing even younger. Listen to Kids, which is now a part of LifeWorks Northwest, is addressing prevention from birth on, and there are a few programs, the Defending Childhood Initiative, which is a national grant that was awarded to Multnomah County, that is also addressing prevention from birth to adulthood. But it is prevention and education are something that is, you know, lacking in funding. A lot of times we, you know, put funding forward for intervention services, which again are critical, but if we're really looking at addressing this issue in a holistic way and eventually, you know, creating a safer community, we also need to look at what resources we're putting toward preventing it from happening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for the chance to speak to you, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, and committee. My name is Anna Williams, and I have been working in the violence prevention movement for 14 years. I know I look young. That's just me being lucky. So I am currently the prevention education coordinator at Haven, which is located in the Dalles, and our service area includes Wasco County, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler counties, and then we also work a little bit in Hood River County as well. So we have this vast service area. Our populations are very concentrated in Hood River and the Dalles, but then we have all these other people that we're trying to work with that are spread out throughout what we call the Frontier Tri-County area. And so what we have found is that, A, students love guest speakers. So I am lucky enough to have two people on my prevention team. It's myself and another woman who's teaching my classes today. And we're in the middle school and the high school every week in the Dalles, and we're in Dufour School. They just have a K through 12 school, so we're in their 8th grade and their 10th grade every week as well, teaching their health classes. And then we go out to the counties, the surrounding counties less often, but we'll do a more sort of in-depth experience where we'll do 3 or 4 days in a row with them. And we do the prevention education, which is very similar to what Megan was talking about in terms of looking at the cultural norms and talking about how people can change what's happening. We identify sources of gender-based violence and the bullying that's happening in the schools and teach kids how to step in and talk to their peers about those things. And we ask kids to report back to us about what's happening with them. And so what we have discovered is that working in a rural environment is quite different. A lot of the prevention programs that we have been looking at from a curriculum standpoint are developed and tested in urban environments, which makes a lot of sense because that's where most of people are. But it's hard for kids to be honest about what's happening to them in a really rural environment, particularly with their health teacher. When their health teacher is talking about healthy relationships, healthy sexuality, you can't raise your hand and say, you know, I was sexually assaulted at a party this weekend in class. And so in order to help kids feel safe and understand that, it's great to have the guest speaker because we're not their teacher, so we're sort of one aspect of safety. But then what we do is at the end of every class, we hand out these little notes, and every kid has to write us something. They can draw a face. They can tell me how cute my hair looks today. But they have to write something on these cards, and then there's some options for them on the back if they want us to follow up with them or whatever. And they all have to turn it into what we call the voice box at the end of every class. And I'm not kidding you, every single time we have gone to a new class where we have new students, we have identified a new victim, someone who is a victim of domestic violence, someone who's been sexually assaulted, and they will write, I need help on this and turn it in, which is that's the first time that they've ever had that chance to ask for help in their location instead of having to go to a new place. So that is huge. And then the other thing I just wanted to say was that I've also worked on the co-located project and done the education around that for our community. And one of the things that I love about that project is that we're able to help the survivors in that context understand that DHS is a helping organization, where a lot of times what they see is DHS is kind of the enemy. They'll transfer their fear of control from the abuser to fear of control from DHS. So they see their abuser used to tell them how to spend their money, who to spend time with, what to do with the children, how much money they could spend on food, and now DHS is doing that. And so it's really hard for them not to just transfer that trauma over to that organization. And that co-located advocate, in our experience, has completely changed that dynamic and can really advocate for DHS with the client and help that system work to really effectively help the client rather than being seen as the enemy.
That's great. I'd really be interested in having you come back at another time to tell us about the results of the working with these middle school and high school children. And is there going to be a longitudinal study so that we can see how effective this is?
There is. We have specific funding, and we're also developing curriculum for K through 6 this summer, which we'll be presenting next year in Dufour as well.
That's great. Wonderful. Thank you. Any other questions of this panel? We are very excited. I think all of us are really concerned about prevention. We certainly need to treat people who are being abused, but we also need to prevent it. That's the most effective, most efficient, and humane way that we can deal with this issue is to prevent it. And we think that starting with children is the way to prevent it, changing that mindset. Representative Gallegos.
I just will comment. I mean, I'm really fascinated by all of this, and that I mean, I've done a lot of field research in Mexico and other places, but I just found it fascinating that in Mexico, literally, the sex education started at first grade, kindergarten. I mean, they were just, this was a Catholic country, and yet it was, you know, it was really part of the effort. On the other hand, they were very slow in recognizing domestic violence, too, so. But it's just an interesting issue, and I think you're right. How do we begin to really develop the education at those levels? Thank you.
Thank you so much. And this is for everybody. You see people coming and going. We're coming toward the end of the session, and so there are lots of committee meetings that we have to go to present our bills that we're trying to pass. So it's not, as no disrespect to you. It's just that people have to go to other places to make sure that the bills that they're supporting are going through other committees. So please don't take this as disrespect or disinterest in your issues. I think we're very interested in what you have to say. So again, thank you very much, and thank you, Sybil.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, and we just feel very lucky to be able to work in Oregon with such great leaders.
Yes,
so thank you.
We're all lucky to live in Oregon. Thank you. We're going to be having an informational hearing on Ending Hunger is Possible, a Plan for Oregon. We have one of our favorites, Patty Whitney Wise and Susanna Morgan.
Thank you very much, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. We're going to start off the panel with myself and Susanna Morgan, the new executive director at the Oregon Food Bank, to give you a little bit of background and overview. And then we have a number of clients and people who are going
to
come present to you with their situations. So, okay. So I'm just going to go ahead and start, and it'll take a minute. That's fine. Okay. So we want to thank you for your interest in this issue. We know many of you have
been quite... Did you say your name?
I'm sorry, Patty. Yes, I did. Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And I want to thank you very much for your interest in the subject. And as a prelude to our discussion around hunger, I wanted to tag on to the conversation you had on Monday with Donna Beagle around poverty and call your attention to a Washington Post article, which is in your materials for today. What is the most important problem facing American children today?
I need to get a little bit further away from this mic.
According to the Academic Pediatric Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics, it is the effects of poverty on the health and well-being of young children. Children are the poorest members of our society, a society that knows how to use policies and programs to raise its citizens out of poverty. It goes on to talk about how 35% of elderly were in poverty, and we put in place programs a number of years ago, so now we only have 9%. Of course, 0% would be better, but we know how to do this, and we need to focus our attention on children and their families as well. And hunger is one aspect of poverty. It's the way that I think we'll end up ending hunger in this state is by really addressing the impact of poverty on families. We'd like to start today with a video. This is video hearing day, apparently. Maybe, maybe not.
Here, let me do it.
Okay. It's just not going forward.
That's what I was afraid of. Or maybe not.
We have little gremlins in this committee room that causes us trouble with videos.
I'm sitting right here.
In your green tie.
If you're running the fudge. You're not running the fudge.
You're not able to get it. I did the verification.
Okay. Here. Do you want to show it?
Yeah. Just if you can minimize that for me.
I'll have to talk to Sybil on how she got hers to read so well right away.
There it goes.
Okay. Thank you. This is from a new show called A Place at the Table about hunger in America.
Uh-uh.
this a problem that people are ashamed of acknowledging?
It's very humiliating.
It's tiring.
What are we going to do?
This generation will live sicker and die younger than the parents' generation.
Hunger is right here in the United States.
And the problem is getting worse.
The reason people are going hungry is not because of a shortage of food, it's because of poverty.
One out of every two kids in the United States at some point will be on food assistance.
I was one of those kids that was hungry. It messes with you.
The average food stamp benefit is $3 a day. There are people who are living on that, and you really can't.
If you have a limited amount of money, you're going to spend it on the cheapest calories you can get, and that's processed foods.
My dream is to go to college,
but I can't tell my kids, I'll make sure you guys eat in 2 years. I'm struggling to even feed my kids every day.
Put that in there.
Okay, that was a bad idea.
As many as 50 million Americans rely on charitable food programs.
I haven't received a pay raise in 4 years, and what I used to spend on a month in groceries now gets me about 2 weeks.
It's amazing how the need has increased.
Charity is a great thing, but it's not the way to end hunger. We're weakening our nation.
I don't really know what to do.
Was a documentary in 1968 that put hunger on the national agenda.
Regular Americans rose up and demanded a modern nutrition assistance safety net, which helped us almost end hunger entirely by the late 1970s.
It showed that public policy could work, political will could work to make a difference in our country.
There's probably 600, 700 chefs here, all really committed to helping this problem that we have with child obesity and hunger.
We're working to make sure that families have access to quality, affordable food.
It's so good.
There's a lot of education that needs to happen around what is healthy food.
Give your ideas for change, for the healthy life of your kids.
We all have a stake in this.
About patriotism, really. If another country was doing this to our kids, we would be at war. And it doesn't have to be that way.
Robin, can you get the slideshow back up? Thank you. As Robin gets our slides up, just a couple of things for the committee. We've historically been a low-wage, high-cost state, and particularly in the last couple of decades, our housing costs and some of our other basic living expenses have gone up much faster than wages in our state. And it's been estimated recently that about 75% of the jobs in Oregon don't pay a family wage. So families are struggling to put food on their table. And oftentimes, food is the one flexible item in a person's budget. If their car breaks down and they need that car for work, if they have a health condition that means they have to run to the emergency room, the food budget is where they find the money to pay for those emergencies, and they go without. Thank heavens for our food assistance programs. They make a big difference in our state, and you can see here that SNAP, the what used to be called the food stamps program, makes the biggest difference. And we have school breakfast and lunch, after school supper, emergency food programs. We have WIC and Senior Farm Direct that provides vegetable vouchers for seniors and low-income families. And these all together, along with the emergency food system, help provide a safety net for families, which we've really needed, especially during this great recession. It's one of the reasons that in our state we focused so much for the last few years on expanding SNAP and making sure that it was reaching the families who are in need. We are serving about 1 in 5 Oregonians right now with the SNAP program. And we have a new report out that's also in your packet on SNAP. There are still some communities that need help, and that includes seniors who are eligible, who aren't participating, and students. And then, of course, there's always new families who are in low-wage jobs or have been let go out of their job that also need the SNAP program. So there's an ebb and flow where families get work and they move on and they don't have to be on the program. And as the trailer pointed out, over our lifetime, 1 in 2 of us will have been on SNAP. map at some point because of our circumstances. So it's a very important safety net program for people. The other thing I just wanted to mention here, it's not going to work, is that we know that in order to solve hunger, it's going to take more than just these food programs, that there are long-term solutions that we're working on. I mentioned the need for family wage jobs. While we're working towards that in our state, strengthening programs like our housing assistance programs, affordable housing, affordable child care, the improvements we've made in the TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, the improvements we've made in the Earned Income Tax Credit program so that families can keep more of their wages to meet their basic needs. These are things that Oregon has made stride on and needs to make more progress on. And together with the food programs we have in place, we can come to a place in our state where there is no more hunger. And I think that's really important for us to realize that it's up to all of us working together to make that happen. At this point, I'd like to turn the mic over to Susanna Morgan, the new CEO at the Oregon Food Bank. We're really pleased to have her in our state, and she comes with great credentials from the state of Alaska and has done a lot of work nationally as well with Feeding America. So I'm really pleased to have her here today, and she'll tell you a little bit about what the Oregon Food Bank has been doing and what they're seeing.
Thank you, Patty. I'm Susanna Morgan. I'm the new CEO of Oregon Food Bank, and I also want to say that Patty has been a mentor to me in my first 6 months here, and that the reason that I came to Oregon was not to escape 8 months of winter, but because I feel like Oregon is best poised among all the 50 states to be the place where we can actually end hunger. The Oregon Hunger Response Fund, Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and Oregon Food Bank working in partnership, mutually supportive, complementary programs with a public partner, private partnership with the state of Oregon and the amazing communities of Oregon all together. This is possible. This is something we can do. It's our job to give you boring statistics, and we have wonderful, wonderful people who have experienced hunger themselves to tell you the stories, but I'm going to buck that just for a minute and tell you a personal story. I have two sons, a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. They're still in Alaska. They're coming this summer. When my 4-year-old was about, it was a very, very difficult child. He didn't grow. He didn't develop the way that he was supposed to. At 15 months, he got a stomach bug, and his appetite didn't recover, and he lost more than 10% of his body weight. And we took him into the doctor, who said, "Well, I'm going to send you to see a nutritionist." Well, I was in charge of his food. I was, you know, making organic, homemade, pureed foods, and I was singing to him to get him to eat. And I burst into tears, you know, thinking I had just been accused by a doctor of starving my child. We went to a nutritionist, which was a horrible experience, but we got the food back into him, and it only occurred to me a week or two later that here I am, the head of the Food Bank of Alaska, and I had the knowledge to cook for my son. I had the money to be able to get enough food, to get healthy food. I had the time to feed him personally twice a day. The health insurance, I had everything going for me, and I was still struggling, and how difficult that must be for so many families. And we learned 2 months later that he has special needs. He has a genetic disorder, and so that was the underlying cause of all of this problem. But for me, it was this moment of realization and compassion of this is what it is like. It is the despair of this is your child, and you can't help him or her in the way that you need to because of the circumstances you're in. And it recommitted me to the work that we do. So briefly, the work of the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Food Bank Network. We have 20 regional food banks throughout the state, including the Marion Polk Food Share right here in Salem that does such an amazing job. Distribute food, 82 million pounds of food, which is about 70 million meals worth of food, through 945 partner agencies, all nonprofits. This is an incredible community-based effort to support food assistance throughout the state. As you can see, we are a small portion of the anti-hunger work that is supported by, through SNAP and SNAP and school meals and WIC and the other pieces, and yet altogether we are still fighting very high food insecurity rates in Oregon, averaging around 18%. The worst places, worst counties, hardest hit counties being, and I've not memorized all 36 of the counties yet, but Josephine, Harney, and Crook stand out in our state for struggling, most number of families struggling with hunger. However, in my mind, 19%, 18% average is way too high in a great state of Oregon, and there's a lot of work for us to still do. We know, just hit the space bar.
This one?
I got it. So hit this arrow.
Oh, that one.
There we go. Some of the basic statistics we know about folks who are fighting hunger, about a third of them are under the age of 18. Again, kids being the most hardest hit range. We also know that about a third of folks who are experiencing hunger are currently working, working full-time, working part-time, or working more than two jobs. Another quarter are actively seeking work. Another third are disabled or retired, can't work for one reason or another. So this myth that people are lazy and they're hungry because they don't want to work is absolutely untrue. In my experience, the folks who are fighting hunger are people who are doing the best that they can. Last little bit of statistics in that we do know about the composition. We do know that two-parent households is the single largest percentage of folks who are fighting hunger. Again, that myth, even though we know that folks who are single parents are struggling disproportionate to their numbers in the workforce. And finally, we know why, we ask people why it is that they've had to go to a food pantry or soup kitchen to seek emergency food, and the single highest reason is because they ran out of SNAP benefits, which tells us that as the previous presenter was talking about, this is a multifaceted problem that requires multifaceted solutions. We know that the charitable solution is only one small piece of the problem, and that it's not that we need charity or SNAP, it's that we need charity and SNAP and more of both if we are going to solve this problem. So that's the kind of quick overview of the hunger challenges that we have here in Oregon. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to come before you today, and we'll bring up some folks who are able to tell some more stories. I think 2-on-1 is going to come up next.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, Suzanne, and welcome to Oregon. We look forward to hearing from you more in the future.
Please. Thank you very much.
We're wanting to hear good news next time.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Chair, while we're waiting to see our other panelists, I want to thank you for Oregon Food Bank's work and advocacy and tying poverty and hunger together. I think that's really critical. I'm sorry the domestic violence people left, because I just want to make the point that, poverty is very much a feminine issue and a gender issue. And I remember 20 years ago, that at a women's congress, international congress, the notion was put forward that we can end world poverty by the emancipation of women. If we can emancipate women, give them more control over their bodies, we would see poverty go down. And it's just a fascinating notion, and as I said, really ties together the whole issue of gender and poverty. So
I think you just expanded my job description.
I think so. Thank you. Yeah, that's
nice. Welcome to the Human Services Committee. Just identify yourself, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Denise Swanson. I'm the Deputy Director for 211 Info. And we are here today to support SNAP and to just give you a little bit of a snapshot about what we are dealing with every day at 211. I think
tell us what 211 is.
211, and the easiest way to tell you is like the 911 of social services. So when a person has an issue or needs help, they can dial 211. It's easy, three-digit number. They can dial, they can email, they can text us, and they can find out where to get resources. So if they're recently unemployed and they've lost their job and they don't know where to turn to because they can't pay their mortgage or they can't pay their rent, they can call 211 and we'll say, okay, well, here's where you can go to, here's where you can get rent assistance, energy assistance, and then we're really good at the art of the second question. So we'll say, so if you're not able to pay your rent, how are you doing with food in the house? How are your children doing? Did you know if you called for a food box that you may qualify for SNAP benefits? So we're kind of giving that information and really providing a compassionate voice for people to be able to kind of calm down and problem solve what's going on in their life and find the resources that they need. Because as you all know, the social service web is not easy to navigate.
Yes.
And particularly with the number of people that we now have coming on to social services that have never had to do that before. And many of these folks are employed people with one or two jobs that just don't have the resources they need to make ends meet on a daily basis. So that's what 211 does. And what we see is what's great about our program is that we collect a lot of data on what's happening in the communities. So last year we know, based on some of the data that I provided in front of you today, that we answered more than 24,000 calls, just on the telephone, for people looking for food-related resources. We suspect that we probably have about an equal number of people coming on their own or case managers coming on looking for resources for people through our website, which we don't have quite the measurement of that down yet, but we're working on that. So we're going to have that kind of data shortly in the future as well. So you can see that it's a huge issue around the state. And SNAP really provides the foundational support for people because often when they're trying to stretch those dollars of, you know, how am I gonna make it through and pay the rent and pay the utilities and get food in the house, sometimes SNAP can free up other dollars so that they can keep the heat on or fix the car that's going to get them to the job when they have that ability to. And I think it's important to note that often people who are receiving SNAP benefits are also accessing community food kitchens and getting food pantry food boxes as well. So it's usually these multiple things together for them to be able to make it to the end of the month. And SNAP, as you're going to hear from a moment from Deidre, who works with me at 211 Info, SNAP is not just about people who are unemployed, but it's about really people who are employed full-time, who are employed part-time, that are still needing to use these resources in order to make it every single month. So I think that part of what we need to do is say, this is not just about the unemployed, this is about our whole community. And like Susanna, I have a personal story as well. I have a brother who is a carpenter and has been on and off work since 2008 with the economy, and so often has to, I feed him a lot of meals. I've had him living in my basement multiple times as he makes it and breaks it and goes in and out with work and such. And SNAP benefits have been a huge piece to him when he has needed them as well to keep food in his house as well. So I'd like to introduce you to my coworker Deidre, who's going to tell you about her personal story. So I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Denise.
Hello. Senator Chair, Senator Tomei, thank you. And I don't know if you're a senator. I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
But thank
I'm
you.
A representative, and just take a deep breath.
Okay.
We're your friends.
Deidre, I have to sit next to her. I'm always nervous.
You have every reason to be.
I just want to thank you guys so much for allowing me the opportunity to tell you my personal story. I'm Deidre Melson. I work for 211. And my employment with 211 gives me the opportunity to be on both sides. Coming here today, it was kind of a challenge. What should I say? I wrote some things down, but I really want to tell you from the heart. And one of my coworkers said to me, when you go there, don't tell them that you receive SNAP benefits. They may think that you're greedy and you're taken from the system. Well, the reality is that if I didn't need them, I wouldn't get them. I get $243 in SNAP benefits for my family of five, which averages out to about $9. But without that $9 a day, I don't know how I would make it. And that's my reality. I talk to people daily who are not there to take away from the system. Most of the time, I'm talking to the working poor. I'm talking to senior citizens. I'm talking to people who always felt like they were given to the system, and now they feel like they're taken away from the system. But it's a situation where they have to depend on this. With the $200 a month, I'm still going to food pantries and trying to figure out how to make it for the remainder of the month. It really is a big part of my budget. It's only $243, but without that, where would I go? I have a son. I have two sons, four children altogether, but one of them is 6'2 and 280 pounds. He's an athlete, he's a wrestler, and a football player, and we want to make sure that he's in shape and he has the right, he's eating the right stuff, he's strong, and we want to put him out there and make sure that he is successful in his future. And SNAP benefits help with that. And like I said, I talk to so many people on a daily basis, and these are not people who are just there to leech and take away from the system. These are people who really, really, really depend on it. Elderly people. I talk to so many people daily who it breaks their hearts to have to call 211 and beg. That's how they feel. They feel like they're begging. They feel like a couple of years ago when they were fully employed, they can give to these food pantries. And now today, they're going to these food pantries. I had the opportunity to be a part of American Winter, which was a documentary that was released just recently. And I got very close with some of the people from that documentary. And one of the families was Pam and Brandon. And Brandon was unemployed, but he ended up getting a job. And they completely relinquished their stance. They decided, well, you know, I'm gainfully employed, and I can do this without it. But I talked to Pam the other day, and she's, like, almost in tears, like, you know, I need my SNAP benefits, but since I let them go, I'm not able to get them back. And so now she's stuck in a position where she has to go to food banks. She doesn't live in the Portland metro area. So where we may be able to go to food banks every 30 days or there's a multiple variety of food banks, she only can depend on a few of them. And they don't have the ability to cover the need. So what do we do with her and her two little boys? How do they make it? How do we all make it as a community? I have a whole complex of people that I live with who work 40 hours a week, but they still depend on these benefits. They're not there to take away from the system, but this is what they have to do in order to survive. And that's our reality. And so I don't have a lot to say, but I do really thank you guys for allowing me to be here. And I want to show my support for the program. I depend on it. I depend on it, and a lot of other people just like me depend on it. So continue to support, and again, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today.
Thank you, Deidre. Indeed, you have a lot to say, mm-hmm. and what you have to say, we need to hear. The newspapers talk about people who violate the system, who are doing really awful things. We know that they're a small minority, but they're the ones that hit the newspapers. You don't hit the newspapers. The family you were talking about doesn't hit the newspapers. And those are the ones we need to hear from. We need to do it as a legislature, as a committee, and as persons who live in this state who need to address these issues of hunger. Nobody in this state, in this country, in this world should be hungry. This is ludicrous. We're a wealthy country. It just should not be allowed. Thank you, Deidre. I know this is the first time you've come to testify, and I know it's not going to be the last. We will be inviting you back, and we'll be asking you to go to other committees. Any other questions from either of these two? I also want to point out, again, you will remember this, and Representative Gilliam, you also will remember, we've worked for years on 211. We need one access point for people to know where they can get help. Sometimes people say, what does the legislature do? Well, this is one of the things, and not just alone. We worked with Human Services, but we made sure that there was one point that people could call to see where they could get services. So thank you for coming to testify today, and thank you for sharing your story with us. And thank you for not reading your testimony. You are a great speaker, Deidre. Thank you.
Thanks for your support. Have a good day.
You're welcome.
Thanks again, you guys. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Now we'll hear from Sarah Flynn, Josh Gwynn, James Gaumond, Rochelle Stevenson, and Jaden Edwards. Hi there. Just remember, please, to identify yourself. We need more young people here. We're so glad you came today. Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Flynn. I'm an outreach coordinator for Oregon Food Bank. The Oregon Food Bank Network delivered a record 1 million emergency food boxes last year, and that was the third year in a row that we have delivered a record number of food boxes. Many people are surprised by that number. They assume that hunger is something that is confined to certain small sectors of our society, certain faraway neighborhoods. But the truth is that in Oregon, there are hundreds of thousands of people, our neighbors, who are going without food and struggle to afford enough healthy food all the time. And that struggle is invisible for the most part. Oregon Food Bank's annual Voices Project, which I help to coordinate, actually holds focus groups with people who've received emergency food in the past year. And we've been doing that for the past 17 years and gone to over 100 locations in the state to have those discussions. So I wanted to start out just by telling you a little bit about the Voices Project. This is this year's report, and we've provided copies to you all. It's full of stories from people across Oregon, and they wanted to tell those stories specifically to legislators. We think that you all are the most important audience for this piece that we produce, and they're so excited to be able to share their stories with you in this way. This is a picture of a Voices focus group, just so you have an idea what it looks like. We have a two-hour community conversation, and the folks who are recruited are, we work with one of our partner agencies, a food pantry, a meal site, a gleaning program, and then the coordinator recruits participants for the focus group randomly. So they aren't specifically trying to reach out to particular folks that they know. We try to get as good a cross-section of the population that needs emergency food assistance as possible. And so these are the locations where we've held focus groups this past year in 2013. So instead of telling you about how important I think these stories are and why, there's somebody who I think could speak to that a little better, and so I just want to share with you her story. Her name is Lois. She lives in Pendleton, and she was at our Pendleton focus group in the last year. And she wasn't able to be here with us today. Lois does not have a phone. Lois does not have access to the internet. But I was able, through letters, to set up a time for a follow-up interview with her. And here's a piece of her story that I'd like to share. Before I started going to the pantry, I struggled for a long time with my provisions. I skipped a lot of meals, and I got to the point where I didn't have anything. I drank lots of water to keep me filled up. When I feel sorry for myself, when I feel like no one cares, when I wonder why I have to struggle so much, I just say to myself, Lois, everybody struggles and you just have to make the best of it. I'm thankful when I have food to put in my cupboard. If it weren't for the food pantry, I know I wouldn't be doing as well as I am. I'm grateful because the pantry volunteers don't have to help us, but they do. They give me canned fruit, frozen vegetables, yogurt, bread, beans, milk, pasta. When I got that food home for the first time, I felt like I'd won the lottery. People at the pantry make you feel good and they care. They always ask about how I am. The other people who get food there, I feel like we're in the same boat without any oars, and I don't feel so alone in this. Since the recession, the pantry sometimes runs out of food, and they always feel so bad about asking us to come back the next day, and it isn't their fault. There are so many people who need help now. I don't go as often as I should because I don't want to take away from children who need the food more than I do. I'm older, and I can get by with what I have. I hope there will always be a food pantry for those who need it. Children, seniors, parents who skip meals so their kids don't have to, and others with burdens I can't even begin to imagine. I don't have much, but I give what I can to people who have less than I do, or who have too much pride to go to the food pantry themselves. I eat a lot of ramen noodles and crackers so I can share my food box and groceries with people worse off than me.
Thank you.
And We brought with us today a couple other people who have stories to share with you, and so I'd like to turn it over to Josh Gwynn to introduce our first story.
Thank you.
So my name is Josh Gwynn, and as the coordinator of a local food pantry here in Salem, I've had a unique access to be able to connect the names, faces, and voices of hunger to the individual and powerful stories that they each have. A few months ago, I hosted a focus group here in Salem, and one of the stories that came out of that group was that of a pantry guest of mine, James. Now, as you hear James's testimony, I think it's important to remember that his voice is one of thousands that I've heard. His story is one of hundreds of thousands in Oregon, that food, when treated as love and not as food, has the ability to access. Now, I believe that's because our work has the ability to transform lives. When we meet the most basic of human needs, hunger, with perhaps the most distinctive of human responses, empathy, the conduit that we use, be it a bag of apples or potatoes or some loaves of bread, transforms into something else. It transforms from that nutritional, monetized item into a gateway that allows us to connect to the hearts and hear the stories of the families that we're visiting. It allows us to hear stories of drought and then determination, of pain and then perseverance, and of hunger and then hope. From my perspective as a local pantry coordinator on the ground, I see a common story that I think may differ from the statistical bird's eye view that you may read about in newspapers or in reports. I see stories of transformation and determination that just continue to break my heart. I see a father who will go to all ends working as a migrant worker on the tree farms, cutting timbers and cutting trees for us 12 hours a day, and then racing to the food pantry so that his wife doesn't have to. I see a wife who can supernaturally juggle two jobs, raising her children, sustaining her husband, and coming in and waiting 2 hours in a food line to be able to feed her children. I see a autistic child who sees that his mother is struggling to provide without his father, and sees that the 2 hours that they're at the food pantry is tough, so we spend 6 weeks together moving closer and closer to other kids so that he can make a friend and give her a little space to just breathe. And it is these stories that allow me to introduce the next speaker, not as a pantry guest, but as a man who lives down the street from me and in my prayers, as a community member that I strongly believe in, as a husband that I admire, and as a beautiful story that I really hope you all hear. James.
We're anxious to hear.
Good afternoon. My name is James Gaumont. I'm 68 years old. My wife is 66. I entered the workforce when I was 17, and my first major employment was in the late 60s when I went to work for Kaiser Steel Corporation in Southern California. I worked in their open pit iron mine. I was a drill operator. I worked in 120 plus degree weather. I worked there until it closed in 1974. While working there, my wife and I thought that we would be able to look forward to a comfortable retirement with the benefits from the mine and the Social Security that I would accumulate. And with our lifestyle that we lived, we figured we could go into our 80s with relatively good health. But like I said, in 1974, the mine closed. The Kaiser ceased all of its operations, its steel mill and its mine. And so we moved that year to Idaho. And I went to work for Sunshine Mining Company in Kellogg, Idaho. I worked a mile down and 4 miles back in the mountain. I did various operations there. I ran a motor, drilled for silver for a while, and did track repair and all manner of work underground. Then in 1986, it closed its doors, and in the Silver Valley where I lived, 1,400 other miners, along with their families, lost their jobs, their pensions, and so had to go to other parts of the land to find other work. So once again, we packed up my family and came to Oregon. But by that time, I was deemed too old to retrain for a job that would provide me with a pension. So I started my own business. I went to Chemeketa Community College and took a 3-year landscaping course, which I completed in 10 weeks, and then started my own landscaping business. And I did that until 1991, when I gave that enterprise to my son-in-law and started a small construction business where I did ADA compliances, being that my wife was disabled. She had polio when she was 18 months old, and 30 years ago started with the late effects of polio. Her ability to walk was first compromised and went to first a manual chair and then a power chair, which was provided by the state, which we were very grateful for. We progressed down to her having swallowing problems and breathing problems. She's now fed through a tube by special pump and formula. And I provide her assistance 24 hours a day, because the state won't pay adequate funding for a care provider that is competent and reliable, and won't pay me to do the job. So I can no longer go out and work. Plus, in 2003, I suffered my first of 3 major heart attacks. I've had a TIA, and congestive heart failure, and now I have 14 stents in my heart, totaling about 167 millimeters. My last stent was February 14th of this year, and so it's very hard to go out and get even a part-time job if I wanted to.
How has the food bank helped you, James?
Huh? We were receiving $67 in SNAP benefits until the first of this year, when I received my 3% cost of living adjustment, and so our SNAP benefits were cut from $67 to $17 a month, and then with the added burden of her having to go to this feeding tube. She was just getting her medicines through the G-tube, and now she has a combination G-J-tube where she's fed 24 hours a day through this setup. Put a real strain on the finances. Plus, I've become a pre-diabetic, and so my nutritional needs have changed greatly to keep me from having to take insulin injections and to keep me out of the hospital. I have certain very strict dietary requirements that I have to have, and even though what I get at the food pantry is only $20 to $25 each week, if I was to go to a grocery store, that $25 a week goes a long ways towards offsetting other expenditures. And so that the food pantry and SNAP helps us greatly. With the SNAP monies we have, I buy my fresh produce and certain other things that are necessary for a heart healthy diet.
Thank you for sharing your story with us, James. I know we're going to be losing our vice chair pretty soon, and we have another panel. We want to hear from everybody, but we know there are other people who are here to speak also. So thank you for staying as long as you can, Representative. So go ahead and tell us your story.
Hello. My name is Rochelle Stevenson, and until recently, I was always a proud working mom. I just want to share this part, that I have my bachelor's degree, my nursing credentials, you know, made enough money to take care of my kids, pay for the house, everything. And always volunteered, you know, in outreach, you know, Toy and Joy Makers and all the things that go on in the community. And then, boom, landed in the hospital with preeclampsia overnight with my fourth child that I just, he turned a year old. And literally, my story is overnight went from making a decent income to having zero income and still three kids at home that were depending on me. At this point, I was kind of at that cusp where I didn't qualify for TANF yet or any assistance because I still was considered employed even though there was no income coming in. I was under the Family Medical Leave Act. 211 was my best friend. It's actually in your cell phones. If you dial 211, it's automatically going to pop up as a community resource. From the hospital, I was calling 211, finding where my son's 15, and he became the man of the house. Where can we go and get help? Because they need to eat, if nothing else. I cashed out all my 401k and everything just to keep the lights and the house going, and solely relied for 6 months on food pantries to feed the kids. Um, My son is now a year old, and he just came home from Randall this week. And
what is Randall?
That's the Children's Hospital here in Portland.
Okay.
So he came off life support on Monday, and we actually brought him home, and he's doing really well now. I'm on unemployment, obviously, because my job ended in the midst of the last year of everything that's happened. I went from about $4,300 a month income to $381 a week on unemployment. We received close to $500 a month in food stamps. My house payment has not changed, obviously, in the midst of all this, so that still has to be met. I have a high schooler who's in sports, and I'm telling you, we find things like Gatorades at food pantries. He actually went in the hospital for dehydration while I was in the hospital because, you know, being 15 and trying to take care of little brothers and feed everybody and that kind of stuff, kind of neglected his own self. But I will say, people have like a stereotype of what food pantries are. They think that they're this place where drug addicts go or, you know, people, like you say, they're lazy. And I may have even at one point in my life thought that, you know, this was somewhere that I would never go to. But I will tell you that they have milk, bread, eggs, cheese, ham, you know, cake, you know, like I even got a birthday cake for one of my kids one time at a food pantry. And the people are always welcoming. And I just don't know what we would have done because you can't make something out of nothing. And I don't know what we would have done without like the Oregon Food Bank referrals and the 211 because I never had to use resources like that before because I always thought I had it all together. So in my personal life, I plan to give back to all of the pantries once everything gets completely situated and I'm able to go back to work full time. And I don't know what else I could tell you about it, but I can tell you that my kids actually enjoy going to the pantries. They're, you know, and when there's something in the house that we don't have, they'll say, well, can we just go to that place down the street? You know, they don't. The younger ones don't quite understand because they are so welcome. They are treated so well that they almost think it's like a fun place to go. But truly, the underlying bottom line is it was a complete necessity in my life in a very scary place that I was at. So, and with TANF, TANF for my family size is $700 a month, and they actually went without electricity for 15 days. So the day that we were granted our TANF, we were able to get the lights back on, and then the day that the SNAP benefits came, it was like Christmas for the kids to go to the grocery store. It was like, as a mom, it was like, oh my gosh, my kids are so excited about getting fruit snacks, you know, but at the same time, it was a reality check of just how important food is emotionally, physically, and what it does to a child when they actually lose that portion of their life. So that's my story.
Thank you for
sharing. And my son Jaden wanted to come talk to you guys today.
Did you want to tell us something? Could you tell us your name first, dear?
My name is Jaden Edwards, and I'm going to tell you about my family experience with hunger. I got used to eating from cans whatever was left. I actually now like kidney beans from the can. I used to be sad when we had no food. Now we go to food pantries and get fresh food, meats, and cool snacks. I even volunteer at the pantry. Now we will never be hungry again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jaden. That was great testimony. I hope you'll come back and visit us again, too. Good.
So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Sarah Flynn for the record. Thank you very much for your time. This concludes our piece of the presentation. If you have any questions or comments, we're open to that.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate sharing your stories with us, and best of luck to you. Thank you, and hope your baby is well and happy. So we have next on the agenda a couple of people who are going to wait and give their testimony at a later time. But we do want to hear from Howard Kenyon. He's the program manager for Northeast Emergency Food Program in the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Thank you so much for coming today.
Well, you did make me do a solo up here. Thank you, Chairman. Chair Tomei and the committee. It's very nice to be here today, and I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Howard Kenyon. I am a member of the Oregon Hunger Task Force and program manager for Ecumenical Ministry of Oregon's Northeast Emergency Food Program, located in Cully neighborhood in Northeast Portland. We serve about 11,000 people a year, unduplicated, out of our small food pantry. And I just want to give you one story, and then share something of my own. There's a young couple that started coming about 3 years ago, about the time I began working there. They've given me permission today. I talked to them. His name is Keith. Her name is Vicky. He lost his work in the auto demolition industry about 4 years ago when the Great Recession hit. And he and Vicky couldn't afford their rent, so they lost the house they were renting. They put their stuff in storage and were couch surfing, and their storage was completely stolen. Everything in the storage was stolen. And when I first met them, they'd come to us with that what I call deer in the headlights syndrome, which is when they walk in having never been to a food pantry before and not sure what to do. And I asked them, I said, well, what can we help you with most? And they said, diapers. It happened to be a day that we didn't have diapers. I told them they can have diapers anytime because I've raised a lot of diapers out of this story. But that was just the beginning of our relationship with them. Actually, their story has gone downhill since then. They've had some good moments. They have housing now. They've had two more children. The youngest was born at the end of March, prematurely. And they're wonderful parents, and Keith has been able to find odd jobs from time to time, but nothing ever permanent. He works very hard, and he works hard at finding work. He is very excited because now, after an injury, he can go back to selling his blood. That's how committed he is to providing for his family. And the longer he's out of work, the more challenges come, because the longer you're out of work, the less you are employable. His story actually gets worse because a couple of years ago he was hit by a texting driver crossing 82nd Avenue at a crosswalk while they were living in one of those cheap hotels, and his leg was shattered. He's walking now with a cane. He's doing therapy. In her last pregnancy, Vicky was discovered to have MS and cervical cancer. They found a couple years ago, they found cheap housing outside of Estacada up in the mountains, up in the foothills, I should say, which was great except when their car broke down. Now they're 7 miles walk from the nearest bus stop. When I talked to Keith today to ask him if I could use the story, he told me that he'd spent 2 hours hiking down off the mountain to catch a bus so that he could go cash a $50 check so that he could buy some diapers. People, as you know and as you've heard all this afternoon, who are poor are not necessarily lazy. They work very hard, and that's the case with Keith and Vicky. What keeps them going are programs like TANF, SNAP, WIC, OHP, and nonprofits like ours, as well as friends and neighbors that give them rides down off the mountain when they need it. Yesterday, and I'll read this little section here, I saw Keith the happiest I've seen him in a long, long time. He came to work for me. We don't pay him, but a deal has been worked out with the Community Solutions, which is Clackamas County. I think it's connected with DHS. I'm a little bit less familiar with that than I am my own work. We don't pay him, but the deal is that instead of submitting 15 resumes a week that go nowhere, as they have for the last 2 years, he comes and works for us for 30 hours, and this will last for 6 months. During this time, he'll, instead of doing the resumes to get his submissions to get his TANF and his SNAP benefits, he will be learning office skills at our place, and he will be putting something new on his resume. First time he's had a real job in 4 years. Now, keep in mind, I'm not paying him a dime, but he was beaming yesterday, and I was reminded of the fact that give a person meaningful work, and it does wonders for their self-esteem. I wish I could give out jobs like I give out food. Thanks to state and federal programs and organizations like the Oregon Food Bank, we give out 600,000 pounds a year, which we, out of cash out of our own organization, spend very little on. I wish I could hand out jobs like that, but they don't come that easily. Now, why am I so compassionate about working with people like Keith and Vicki? And as I say, I see thousands of these people every year. It's because of my own story. I have a doctorate degree, a PhD from Baylor University that I earned a generation ago. I've directed nonprofits all my life as a missionary overseas and here in the States with our church. I've supervised as many as 150 employees at a time, but 4 years ago, I too was out of work, spent the longest year of my life looking for a job and found a part-time job at that time with the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. My wife had a part-time job, and I'm not ashamed to say today, because I believe it helps other people, is that what has helped get us through is EITC over the last 4 years, and the fact that the emergency food program is something I can benefit from as well. My pay is increasing, it's improving, but like a lot of people, this is a long haul. I like to say it's like the Nike swoosh, it's just taking a long time to get up there. And we've managed to move ahead step by step, only after draining all our life savings, which I'm 58 now, so there's not a whole lot of time to regain that. And I'm not saying this to say, if you feel sorry for me, there are folks that have been here today that have far worse stories than I do. It's just to say why I understand what Keith and Vicki are going through and why I understand why work is so important to them. I'm working two jobs now. My wife has gone back to school. I'm very proud to be able to find small ways to help Keith feel fulfilled for the next 6 months and hopefully have him find work because of that. I don't have all the answers. There are experts in this room in front of me and behind me. But I do think that the answers that we are going to find involve community, all of us, government, business, nonprofits, faith-based groups, neighborhoods, family, all of us pulling together so that people like Keith and Vicki aren't left in the woods with no way out. And I thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Howard, for coming today and telling us your story and your work. Any quick questions?
Okay.
Thank you so much. We also had on the agenda Philip Kennedy Wong and Robin Johnson, and we will have you come back another time. So thank you so much. It's a heavy load. Mm-hmm. It's a heavy load. Thank you, committee. Thank you for saying.
I just wanted to say one thing was the prenatal care. Okay, the theme of prenatal care and the WIC Farm Direct is, you know, one of the things that can get at that. But I that was an underlying theme that didn't get actually pulled out. But when you see the trouble that people had in pregnancies, in part because of the distressed situation they were in, and how that threw them further into poverty, I just think we need to continue to keep that high on the radar as well.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm going to take the opportunity now. We're going to be having a program integrity workshop that will be from in our committee. Representative Gallegos has agreed to be on that. Representative Kenny Geyer. Representative Olson will chair that. And Representative Gene Wisnett has also agreed to be on that. So that group will be meeting during the interim. So we'll be hearing more from folks like you about these programs and if there are ways that we can make them better, and encourage people all who need these programs to take advantage of them. Reach out. We need to do that. Yes,
can I say one more thing? Because I'm not sure when Philip and Robin will have a chance to go. So if the committee members here, in particular the one that serves on the Human Service, Health and Human Services sub, look at the legislative agenda for the Hunger Relief Task Force. There's a number of different bills that have been put forward, as well as supporting programs, the family stability programs that are listed here, EITC, ERDC, TANF, jobs programs, et cetera. So I know we've heard about all these before, and I know you will have an opportunity to talk about them again, but just keep those on our radar too.
Thank
especially you.
Absolutely. We'll put on all the members of Gallegos over there. Great. Any last words? Thank you, committee,
thank you very much.
Sticking with this, and thank you all for coming today. With that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Health.